This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the final part in our week-long series, Taking the Long View, we'll look at the Islamic world 10 years out and envision the best and worst case scenarios for this troubled part of the world. First, the week's casualties and small victories on the economic front. Last week, we talked with Wall Street Journal economics reporter Greg Ipp about the record-high unemployment levels. Today, I asked him what Washington is doing to shore up the economy.
Last week we had economic data tell us that we are almost certainly in a recession and possibly a nasty one. This week we've had signs that at least some parts of Washington, they're trying to do something about it. Most importantly, on Tuesday, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates a full half percentage point. Their benchmark rate dropped from 2.5% to 2%, which is the lowest it's been since 1961. And just to give you an idea, on Wall Street they were split on whether the Fed would go a quarter or whether they would go a half. And the fact that they decided to go the half percentage point suggests that, number one, they're very concerned about the economy. Number two, they don't want to hold back any of their firepower in terms of getting something going on this front. On the government spending and tax cut front, it's not quite as encouraging. We have a situation where the Democrats in the Senate and the Republicans in the House are considerably at odds on the best way to put more money into the economy in coming months and to get people spending again. The Democrats have passed through the one of their committees in the Senate a package that emphasizes more spending and payments to workers. The Republicans in the House have preferred tax cuts for business, and as yet we have not found the common ground. So it looks like it could be the middle of December before we get that badly needed stimulus.
Greg, we saw a big drop in wholesale prices in October. And it brings to mind the Japan story, where they've had a decade of deflation, not inflation, even when they took interest rates very, very low. Does the specter of Japan's economic malaise hang over the U.S. now, or do people see that we're not likely to follow that path?
For some time, people have been wondering whether the bursting of the NASDAQ bubble here in the United States and the end of the so-called new economy suggests that we're headed for something like what they've experienced in Japan, where they too had a stock market bubble burst. That was in 1989, and that was followed by 10 years of painful economic stagnation. There are a lot of troubling parallels. Now, we should add that there's a lot of differences, and the majority of economists who have looked at this issue do not think that we're headed down the path of Japan. But we shouldn't be ignorant of the similarities and the fact that, we've dropped interest rates to extremely low levels and still have not made progress in getting the economy to grow again is certainly a troubling similarity and one we have to be aware of.
What's the source of these steep drops in wholesale prices?
Well, part of it is a reversal of the dramatic run-up in petroleum and gas and other energy prices that we experienced through most of 2000, and that is now unwinding very rapidly. The weak economy has left the world basically glutted with oil, which is the opposite of the situation we thought we had just a year ago. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened is that, as anybody who's shopped for a car recently will tell you, the deals available on new cars are just phenomenal. 0% financing from all of the big three automakers, at least until the middle of this month. And that had a big downward impact on prices. But beyond that, deflationary forces are quite profound. Essentially, if you look at producer prices, they haven't actually risen at all in a year. And intermediate prices, things like for construction materials, chemicals, et cetera, they haven't risen in 5 years on net.
Is that considered deflation or just holding steady?
Depends on where you compare it to, but certainly if you ask any businessman who is being asked by his customers to lower prices every given year, it certainly feels like deflation, and it's getting worse. And you sort of get the feeling that, well, if we could lower prices because we kept putting in new productivity, improving techniques and so on, well, this is a good thing because we'd get higher sales, higher profits, everybody would be happy. But right now it feels like it's just price cutting to get stuff off the shelves, and it's starting to feel a little bit more dangerous.
Beyond automobiles, where the deals have been so great, have consumers seen fallen prices?
Retail markdowns have been pretty widespread. The retail sales picture got significantly worse in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And a lot of stores have had to discount inventory that's piled up. Now, a lot of chains have tried to be disciplined in terms of their ordering for the holiday shopping season in the hopes that they can get through that period without dramatically cutting prices again. But if we have more worries about terrorism or security, then that's going to put a damper on shopping as well, and I expect that would result in pretty steep cuts to prices as well.
How are housing prices holding up?
Housing prices are still rising, the last data that we've seen. We had been, up until this year, looking at typical gains in housing prices of 7% to 8%. that's slowed probably to the 3% to 4% area, and it may be slowing further as the market softens in the wake of the terrorist attacks. And that's going to be a bit of a concern of the Federal Reserve. They've been counting on rising real estate wealth to offset some of the weakness to people's spending power that was resulting from the big drop in their stock market portfolios. So if there's pressure on people's housing wealth, that's going to be yet another negative that we have to deal with in the economy.
But the stock market did make something of a rally this week, and that's even in advance of a stimulus package passing.
Yes, the stock market, as always, is looking ahead. They got more interest rate relief on Tuesday than they had expected, and they are counting on the people in Washington to do the right thing and pass a stimulus package of some kind in coming weeks. And there's also perhaps a sense of hope or optimism that, bad as things have gotten in a lot of business areas, such as technology, that they can't get much worse. And in fact, when you look at all the initiatives being undertaken to get the economy growing next year, lower interest rates, lower taxes, lower energy prices, perhaps profits will look pretty good. The counterargument to that, unfortunately, is that we're still at extremely high levels of valuation on many of these stocks. We're looking at 20 to 30 times earnings, which is kind of a very highly valued market, even when the economy is growing, never mind when it's in recession. So it's way too early to say that this rally is going to last.
Greg Ipp is an economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I spoke to him earlier from his office in Washington. Professor Fawaz Jirjiz says he's not surprised that the devastating terrorist attacks on September 11th stemmed from the Middle East. He says the roots of those attacks have been growing for decades as the United States has pursued foreign policies that amounted to a slap in the face for the Islamic world. Tonight, the last part in our Taking the Long View series, we look at the Islamic world 10 years out and imagine the possibilities. Does Islam fit into the future most Americans have come to expect? How? And if it can't, whose expectations, whose reality is going to change? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from New Jersey is Fawaz Jirjiz. He's chair of the Middle East and International Affairs Department at Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, and author of America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests. Good evening, Professor Jirjiz.
Good evening.
And in the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Do we have Jack?
Hey, hello, Tom.
Oh, hi. There you are.
I'm here.
Up in the Green Mountains. You're with us.
Yes.
Good.
It takes a while to get the sound.
Yeah, the Pony Express will get us there. Professor Jirjiz, we've all been watching everything that's shaping up here, learning a lot as we go. And this week we've been trying to look way out. Tonight we're trying to look really through some of the fury and frenzy of the moment to see where this will all end up. But to understand what may be on the other side of this immediate crisis, help us understand. President Bush has worked hard from the beginning not to frame this as a conflict of the West and Islam, yet there seems a kind of an inevitability to some of that. It just has come up right out of public opinion, if nothing else, at least in the Islamic world. What of this conflict we're in stems from foreign policy clashes, and what from fundamental philosophical differences, from different and conflicting worldviews?
Well, this is really a highly critical question. What we need to remember is that in the last 30 years, anti-American sentiment has become deeply entrenched in Arab political culture. In fact, anti-American sentiment has become staples of Arab politics. The United States has really very few friends in that part of the world. In fact, the only friends we have are the ruling elite, who tend to be highly unpopular by their population. In the last 30 years, the United States, consciously or unconsciously, has managed to alienate most of the rising social classes in the Arab and Muslim world. I have just returned from the Middle East after spending 2 years as a MacArthur Fellow conducting field research on relations between the Islamist movements and the West, particularly the United States. And I can tell you very clearly and very decisively that it's so difficult to find a single social group in the Middle East, in the Arab and Muslim world, that has positive views on American politics, American foreign policy, and American society. It's not just the Islamists who tend to be anti-American. The conservatives, the nationalists, and even the liberals tend to be as anti-Americans as the Islamists. And the question is, why? What has happened in the last 45 years?
Well, that's what we want to get into that tonight. I think a lot of Americans are getting focused on this. You might say at long last. People feel ready to roll up their sleeves and try and go in and fix this relationship. But I think the question then at the outset is, well, is it just a matter of fixing, not that they're small, some very significant foreign policy postures? Or even if we did all that, even if we come completely to terms with the Islamic world in foreign policy terms, will there remain some insurmountable difference in worldview that will leave us at loggerheads?
Again, by the way, I just want to make a critical qualification here.
Please.
The deepening of anti-American sentiment in the Arab and Muslim world is neither intrinsic nor irrational. This is not really a philosophical or a natural or intrinsic hatred toward the United States. Unfortunately now, we have some commentators here in the United States mm-hmm. who claim that Arabs and Muslims hate America and Americans because it's a liberal, secular, democratic system. It's nonsense. The same people, by the way, who are critical of the United States would like to have some of the democracy we have here in the United States and some of the open society we have here. In addition, under this thin layer of anti-Americanism lies a great deal of fascination and attraction with the American idea and the American dream. In fact, many of the people I spoke to who are critical, who tended to be critical of America, would love to come to America and share in the American dream. What I'm trying to say here is that the deepening of anti-American sentiment is a product of concrete historical conditions in the last 45 years. There are some major foreign policy issues which really lie at the heart of the anti-American sentiment in that part of the world.
Okay, we don't want to let go of this philosophical conflict issue. It may be nonsense, but we want to understand it. But before we go there, what then are the foreign policy burdens that you see as most key to getting to the other side of this bad impasse?
There's an arsenal of accumulated grievances against the United States. Most Arabs and Muslims resent America's decisive support for Israel and its neglect of legitimate Palestinian rights. The Palestinian issue remains the leading Arab political identity issue today. The Arab-Israeli conflict has truly poisoned Arab-American relations and done a great deal of damage to America's image in that part of the world.
Can we look at a very simple issue there that I think will help Americans think into the future? If Israel were out of the occupied territories, would that be enough? Can America stick with its alliance and friendship with Israel, stand up for Israel's existence, and still have, looking years out if necessary now, a good relationship with the Islamic world?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, nobody is saying, by the way, even if we remove tomorrow the Palestinian-Israeli conflict out of the equation, you're going to have anti-American sentiments. You're going to have irrational people who hate America and American democracy and American foreign policy. What I'm trying to say is that the Palestinian-Israeli issue is one of the most existential and critical issue in how Arabs and Muslims perceive America and American foreign policy. This is not the only issue. I mean, many Arabs and Muslims tend to be also to be highly critical of America's close affinity and associations with the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. Bin Laden and his ilk have exploited this issue and have drawn a parallel between Arab official authoritarianism and oppression and Washington's political and military support. Arabs and Muslims also point to the fact that while the United States portrays itself as the champion of democracy and human rights, it supports some of the most oppressive regimes in that part of the world. The Iraqi issue, the continuing tragedy of Iraqi civil society, and the death of tens of thousands of Iraqi children as well, also plays a detrimental role in how Arabs and Muslims perceive the United States. So there is an arsenal of accumulated grievances. But I would go further to argue that even if the United States remove all these issues from the equation, you're going to have some irrational people, some people who really hate America. But this, if you try to tackle these underlying issues and grievances, you're going to remove almost 80-90% of the underlying tensions between the United States and the Muslim world.
That would be comforting, but we want to dig all the way down tonight. We're talking about the future of the Islamic world, the long view, its relationship with the West, and in particular with the United States, with Professor Fawaz Jerjes. He's chair of the Middle East and International Affairs Department at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, and our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Do you think the U.S. can find peace and harmony with the Islamic world? I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're taking a quick break. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're taking the long view tonight of the Islamic world and its relationships with the rest of the world, and in particular with the United States. What do you think? Do you think Islam will find a way to happily engage with the modern globalizing world? And if not, what will that mean? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Fawaz Jerjes. He's chair of the Middle East and International Affairs Department at Sarah Lawrence College in New York and author of the forthcoming book, The Islamists and the West, based on his experiences living in the Middle East for the past 2 years as a MacArthur Fellow. Also with us is our news analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack, Professor Jerjes is saying that the notion of a deep philosophical difference is nonsense, that it's 80 to 90% foreign policy problems that is behind the bad blood. That's a deep list of problems to begin to address.
Yeah, it is. And I wonder what part economic grievances and problems play in this. I was just reading, for example, that just in the last decade, real average income per head has declined in Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Syria, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen, whereas Turkey, which is more open to world trade, has actually had an increase in per capita income, as has India, as has China. So on the one hand, the remedy for the future here would seem to be open these societies toward globalization, toward more trade, and see the increase in per capita income. But that's a problematic prescription, because what we hear is that it's globalization that is one of the antagonistic forces that brings out the radical Islamists. And then on the other hand, we say, well, we need democracy in these regions because, as Professor Jerjes just said, this is what the people need. They have repressive governments and so on. In fact, you could make a case that it's the domestic arrangements of Egypt and Saudi Arabia that are our enemies here, because they are exporting their terrorists. There's no political life for these people to participate in, so they become radical Islamists. But if you say democracy is the cure, well, the problematic there is, wait a minute, if you open these societies to democracy, won't that just mean that either by the ballot or perhaps not by the ballot, the Islamists will get control? So these two nostrums for the future, globalization and democracy, just seem to be very, they're problematic. I wonder what Professor Jerjes thinks of that.
May I add a footnote here?
Yes, please,
it
more than that.
It seems to me that we always pose the questions between either or. The dilemma facing U.S. policymakers in the Middle East is how to equalize the concern for human rights and structural reforms with the need to take account of the larger issues of regional stability. Mm-hmm. Nobody is saying that the United States should really give up on its allies, on pro-Western Middle Eastern allies. The United States must balance its support for the existing governments with the need to safeguard and advance the rule of law and more representative governments. The choices facing the United States and the region should not be framed in terms of either having its allies abdicate in favor of the Islamist opposition or supporting the regime's crackdown against the legitimate opposition in Egypt, in Jordan, in the Gulf, and in other countries as well. So the challenge facing Washington is to assist and nudge the ruling authoritarian elite to gradually reform their closed political system and integrate the rising political classes, the alienated 60% youth, as you know, and while at the same time maintain checks and balances to ensure a smooth political transition. Sadly, Washington and American policy, our American policymakers, have allowed their short-term security calculations to prevail over our commitment to open society and liberal values. Mm. It's no wonder why we have lost the high moral ground in the eyes of most Arabs and Muslims.
We take your point there. We're trying to look ahead and help us understand now this angry situation is created. And I think a lot of Americans quail at the challenge of trying to disarm this and get through to a more democratized future. How would the U.S. go about assisting that? It feels like something that would blow up when you try and begin to touch it.
I am quite, it's very disheartening. It's very disheartening to look at the political landscape in the Arab world. While in the 1990s, that the democratic wave that swept the world, most of the world, that particular wave did not reach the shores of the Middle East.
Is that the fault of the United States? Is it the fault of Washington?
Not at all. Not at all. And this is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. It seems to me here that if you look at the political landscape, both the authoritarian regimes and the dominant powerful Islamist opposition are two sides of the same coin. They tend to be anti-democratic and anti-liberal. And the critical question, the conceptual question, how can you have democracy when you have few Democrats? How can you have a viable civil society when you have, both the authoritarian regimes and the dominant opposition who tend to be anti-democratic? How can you create transparent institutions and a viable civil society in such a situation? And here, we must acknowledge that there are limits to what the United States can do. I mean, the United States can do very much in terms of, you might say, taking stock of its foreign policies. The Arab-Israeli conflict, the Iraqi crisis, its close affinity with the bloody dictators in the Middle East. But surely the United States is not responsible for the consolidation and perpetuation of authoritarianism from the dining table to the bedroom.
But if there are limits to what the U.S. can do, does that suggest then that we have to just hunker down and wait for these regimes to dissolve into some kind of Islamist backlash? Well, then what are the practical things the U.S. could do?
I said the challenge is to really maintain checks and balances while try to nudge and exert pressure on America's pro-Western regimes to open up the political system, to gradually reform, to integrate the alienated social classes into the political field, to put in place open structures in order to catch up with the globalization and the economic structure in the world.
Do you think the United States has the power or the delicacy to do what you've just prescribed? It sounds really daunting.
Well, absolutely. Nobody is saying, by the way, that this is an easy task. Nobody is saying somehow that the United States can change the political culture overnight. And nobody is saying that even if the United States was to get deeply engaged in this particular democratic project, that somehow this particular engagement will not produce opposite results. We know in politics, political actions often produce opposite results. So that's not the question. But at the same time, for the last 45 years, that the United States pursued a particular policy, consciously and unconsciously, has alienated most of the rising social classes in the region. That particular policy or policies have proved to be a dismal failure. And the question is, are we to continue on the same path, or are we to take stock of these particular policies? Are we to continue to maintain the same close links with the corrupt regimes in that part of the world, or are we somehow to invest greatly and considerably in civil societies? How do we show the human face of America? I mean, for God's sake, there's more to the United States than its foreign policy. There's more to the United States than Washington, D.C. Why not use the human resources at our disposal to engage Muslims in a serious and genuine debate about the underlying reasons for their grievances? Why not invest in civil societies, in health, in education? Why not build more libraries? Why not provide hundreds and thousands of scholarships? Why not build an army of good ambassadors in that part of the world? What I'm trying to say, there are so many concrete, tangible steps that the United States can take in that part of the world, which might somehow begin a new process, of relationships with the Arab and Muslim world. Nobody is suggesting somehow that the United States has it in its power to change the political culture, to change, the way Arabs and Muslims perceive themselves and the world. But at least we have to start from somewhere, since our policies for the last 45 years have not taken us too far.
Jack Beatty, that's a long list of practical steps that Professor Fawaz Jirjaz outlines there. Can you see the U.S. heading down that path, and would you head down it with confidence of success at the other end?
As he was talking about this problem, it sounded almost like Tsarist Russia desperately trying to reform before the revolutionaries take control. And like Tsarist Russia, the authoritarian regimes, you know, push the liberals and the Democrats right in with the Islamists in their repression. I'm interested in a question raised in another of the professor's articles about the role of Arab intellectuals in this modernizing, democratizing project. You've written critically about Arab intellectuals, and you've said that they're sort of regime intellectuals, kept intellectuals in a way, and you want them to be more critical. Could you lay that out for us?
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, this is a major problem that it seems to me. The question is, how do we reach the Arab and Muslim publics? How do we reach the Arab and Muslim publics over the heads of their corrupt governments and also, public commentators and civic society leaders who tend to be anti-American? It's truly a formidable task. Unfortunately, you don't have the independent intellectual who has a particular social base in society and who really advances a liberal agenda in the Arab world. It seems to me that the political process in the Arab world in the last 50 years has not really, helped to bring about an independent intellectual elite who tend somehow to, construct a different theoretical and conceptual agenda separate from the government. In fact, on the whole, Arab intellectuals and commentators, on the whole, have served as cheerleaders for the regimes, whether it's Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, whether they for the Arab nationalists, and even now for the Islamists. It's really fascinating to see the shift on the part of Arab intellectuals in the last 50 years. Between 1950 and 1975, most intellectuals tend to serve as cheerleaders for the pan-Arab nationalist regimes that existed in the region. Since the mid-1970s, most intellectuals, by the way, shifted gears and now shifted loyalties and tend to be Islamist. And I think this close affinity and association between the intellectuals and the dominant political tendencies have done a great deal of damage to civil society. This is why, in a large part, that civil society in the Middle East has not been able to stand on its own feet, that Arab civil society remains dependent on the political structures in that part of the world.
Professor, stand by. We have callers who want to join us. We're talking about the future of the Islamic world and its relationship with the West, with the United States in particular. We're taking the long view. Do you think the United States can find peace and harmony with the Islamic world? How might it happen? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Howard is on the line. Welcome, Howard. You're on the air.
Hi. This is obviously a very complex issue. Your guests' statements and arguments are similarly complex. Mm-hmm. And I'm no longer sure that I understand his position. It seemed to me he started out by placing a good deal of the blame for the current situation on the West. It seems to me, however, and I have to say I really despair of any solution to this problem. It seems to me there are three problems and three questions that we really that really have to be addressed before this problem will be solved. Question number one, why is it that the masses and even the intellectuals in these Arab countries are blaming the United States for their problems instead of trying to shoot their own leaders or blow up the palaces in their own countries? Why are they bringing their violence to our country?
Okay, Howard, number two, number three.
Okay, number two, it seems to me that inherent in Islam is an anti-democratic view, okay, that just is, there's no way of overcoming that. And problem number three, How does anybody expect these rulers of these Arab countries to give up all that money and use the money for the benefit of the people? Why haven't they done so thus far?
Howard, it's a rich list. Let us put it to Professor Jirjaz. And if we could, let's take that second one first. Is there something anti-democratic that's based somehow culturally in Islam itself?
Well, I mean, I think this is a highly complex question, and I know that in the aftermath of the tragedy on the 11th of September, many commentators have put the question of Islam on the table.
Well, we don't do it. We try not to do it in a cheap way.
Absolutely. We should. I mean, that's not the question. It seems to me that when we talk about Islam, we're talking really about many Islams. It's very difficult to say there is one interpretation of Islam. There are many interpretations. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you have enlightened liberal Muslims. On the other hand, you have conservative and reactionary Muslims. On the other hand, you have some fascist Muslims like Osama bin Laden. So it's very difficult to say which particular Islam we're talking about.
But doesn't that duck the question a little? Isn't there in the Quran, in the fundamental teachings, do you see something that works against democracy or not?
Well, in this particular sense, by the way, you might say that most religions tend to be quite autocratic and have a particular view of the world and the other and the self. But let me take the argument a bit higher here, and to say that the most difficult obstacle for democracy in the Arab world is the entrenched culture of patriarchy and authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of years of political oppression have done a great deal of damage to civil society and stifled and brutalized political culture.
Not just colonial oppression.
These are concrete questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me we have to focus on the concrete historical issues mm-hmm. that really play a detrimental role when we talk about democracy. The middle class, which usually tends to be the vehicle of democracy, hardly exists in the Arab world. It's in a state of siege. It has been decimated in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Algeria. How can you have democracy without having a very viable and critical mass of middle class? Most governments in the Middle East have failed to develop economically, and as you know, you just said a while ago, that somehow, in fact, the Middle East is really down the list of countries that somehow have any kind of economic growth or have done well mm-hmm. at all economically. Not to mention, of course, that there is down there both the dominant opposition and the elite tend to be socialized into this anti-democratic culture.
So let's take that as a difficult one, and I want to get another question raised by Howard was, what about the wealth that's concentrated in the autocracies here? The folks at the top are not eager to let go.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the question is, at the end of the day, the responsibility for reforms and for democracy is internal. We have two questions here. The first question, we were talking about the reasons for the underlying, the underlying reasons for the deepening of anti-American sentiments. There are concrete historical reasons. First, we have to address the questions. I mean, that's a question separate from the question why Middle Eastern societies have not been able to really become democratic and evolve transparent and accountable institutions.
We take your distinction. We take it.
Mm-hmm. There are two questions on the table. To address the underlying reasons for anti-American sentiment helps to a large extent in, for example, marginalizing a person like a professional killer like Osama bin Laden, whose message resonates in the imagination of many Arabs and Muslims. So we have to address it, because if we don't do that, you're going to have an accumulation of resentment, and you're going to have, obviously we're going to deal with a terrible issue of terrorism. So to address this question is, I suppose, to a large extent, separate from the question why Middle Eastern societies do not somehow or have not been able to evolve democratic institutions.
We're talking about Islam and its future. We're trying to take the long view tonight. It's a dense thicket to look through. Not easy, but we're getting good guidance from Fawaz Jurjez, professor and chair of Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College. Also from our news analyst, Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255 or join online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. We're taking a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're taking the long view tonight of the Islamic world and its relationship with the rest of the world, with the United States in particular. We're joined by Chair of the Middle East and International Affairs Department at Sarah Lawrence College, Professor Fawaz Jurjez. Professor, we really are trying to take this view tonight. It's such a thicket. Please help us with a simple exercise. You've been on the ground there. You know the area well.
If everything was done as well as it can be, given it's an imperfect world, look out 10 years. What's the best situation you can picture, given where we're starting? It's not a very good place we're starting. Where could we get to in terms of political reform in this region, economic integration, international cultural harmony?
Yes. I mean, this is a long list of complex questions. It seems to me if history is our guide, I don't think that the political landscape will be much different in the next 10 years in the Middle East from what it is today. You have in place very entrenched political structures. And as we know, that political elite and give up power they don't give up power very easily at all. On the other hand, the dominant opposition, the dominant, most powerful opposition, tend to be as anti-democratic as the existing regimes. It seems to me the situation is highly polarized. How would you have a breakthrough in the absence of a third alternative force in society?
Mm-hmm.
How would you have a breakthrough when civil society hardly exists in that part of the world? How would you have a breakthrough here without somehow a kind of an intervention by an external human agency? And here, when I say that the United States can play a decisive role, it can, because on the whole, the United States is not only perceived to support and sustain the entrenched political regimes, but it also perceived to somehow have a kind of tremendous influence on the ability to survive. And it seems to me that given everything else, that the United States can do really wonders in not only imposing a particular vision, not at all, that's not really what's required, but it also in trying to nudge its own allies to gradually reform, to put in place certain, I mean, transparent and accountable institutions, to open up the political field gradually, while maintaining checks and balances. Unfortunately, I don't see, I mean, any particular third alternative force in Middle Eastern societies, in particular in the major Arab countries, that can somehow really make a decisive breakthrough in the next 10 years without a kind of help from the outside world, particularly from Europe and the United States.
But Jack Beatty, what a difficult challenge to be both at sword tips with the region on a war footing and at the same time to try and be an agent of change in this minefield.
Yeah, you know, and the professor talks about their grievances against us. But what about our grievances against them? Here's a regime, Saudi Arabia, that sponsors radical Islamist, anti-Semitic, anti-American thought around the world through its madrasas, through its support of religious institutions that take the hardest possible line, and we're propping them up. Now, can't we go to them and say, all right, you want us to change, but by God, you've got to change too. We can't protect a country that is actually creating terrorists and the mindset of terrorists against us. This is absurd. That's our grievance with them, and they've got to change too.
What about that, Professor Georges?
Jack, you, I think you're asking the wrong question here. The question to my mind is, why has American foreign policy fully supported and embraced the highly fundamentalist and conservative regime in Saudi Arabia? Why haven't American policymakers been more outspoken in their criticism of one of the most closed and fundamentalist regimes in the Middle East? Why did the United States send 500,000 soldiers in 1990 to safeguard the viability of this particular regime? Why does the United States have a major military force to basically safeguard the security of this particular regime? I mean, absolutely. That's why a professional killer, an irrational man like Osama bin Laden, is able to exploit and manipulate the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia and say, listen, the regime in Saudi Arabia survives because the United States wants it to survive. The regime survives because the United States has a military force there to protect it against the wishes and the aspirations of its own population.
So you're chalking this up to a cynical desire for oil and the hell with the rest?
But that's the conventional wisdom in that part of the world. People tell you, why does Saudi Arabia need to purchase armament worth almost $50 billion between 1990 and 1999? while it does not really have an effective army. As some people have put it to me, it's the biggest robbery in history. I mean, the question is, it's not really somehow looking at it from our own perspective, but we also need to understand the concrete policies that the United States has pursued in the last 45 years. To what extent, I ask, to what extent has American foreign policy or does American foreign policy reflect the ethos and the values of the American public right now? To what extent is the imperial foreign policy of the United States has done a great deal of damage, not only to our image overseas, but also in terms of costs to human lives and also philosophical and philosophical aspects. It's essential for us to raise critical and painful questions about our foreign policies and what our foreign policy elite has done in the last 45 years without justifying and rationalizing the murderous ilk Bin Laden and what he did and what he has done.
Fawaz Jurjis, we take your point, and it's clear we've only got another minute, but we asked for your best case scenario. It didn't sound too great, but we took it. What's the worst case? What if this doesn't improve? Where may we head?
Well, the worst case scenario is that you're going to have civil wars in most Middle Eastern civil societies like what happened in the 1990s. Let's remember that Egypt and Algeria, two of the key Arab states, had major insurgencies throughout the 1990s. In Algeria, more than 100,000 people have been killed as a result of the insurgency between the existing regime and the militant Islamist opposition. In Egypt, a few thousands were killed. The question is, if reform does not take place, if the situation continues as it is, if a breakthrough doesn't happen, the fear is not only economic, the economic situation is going to deteriorate, but the fear is that most Middle Eastern societies would fail, and produce major turmoil and upheaval that might have a spillover effect into the outside world, including Europe and the United States. That's the fear.
Well, it's clearly had that spillover effect already, and we're all... That's what has us all at the table, sadly, but that's why we're here. Professor Fawaz Jurjis, you challenge us in more ways than I can count in this hour. Thank you for spending the time with us.
It's a pleasure.
Fawaz Jurjis is Chair of Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. He's author of America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. This week saw President Bush making a public relations push, working to boost morale at home while working to shore up support among European governments as backing among the European public waned. Here are some sounds from the week.
The last time I was in Warsaw, I talked of our shared vision of a Europe that is whole and free and at peace. I said we are building a house of freedom whose doors are open to all of Europe's people and whose windows look out to global opportunities beyond. Now that vision has been challenged. We will not wait for the authors of mass murder to gain the weapons of mass destruction. We act now, because we must lift this dark threat from our age and save generations to come.
Gurum said the weapons were for personal protection and should have been in his checked luggage.
It just happened out of accident in a hurry. That is all it is.
Officials don't believe he was planning a terrorist attack.
Let's greet the next mayor of the greatest city in the world, Michael Bloomberg.
This was a very tough, close race. But the good news is we have won.
We cannot know every turn this battle will take. Yet we know our cause is just and our ultimate victory is assured. We will no doubt face new challenges, but we have our marching orders. My fellow Americans, let's roll.
Forces entered the Mazar-e-Sharif city from west and south of Mazar
Now he's fully controlling the city, including the airport and other military bases.
Sounds of the week, as President Bush and his administration attempt to rally opinion at home and abroad behind the war on terrorism, sounds of reports of a man trying to board the airliner in O'Hare at O'Hare Airport in Chicago with knives and almost succeeding, sounds of a world still trying to get a grip on this crisis. Jack Beatty, if it's going to be as hard as Fawaz Jojez suggests, it looks to me like a long-term Fortress America is almost inevitable. And at the same time, he says we have to reach out and almost be the third force in the Middle East that introduces optimism, democracy. How do we stay open, optimistic, engaged? How do we stay determined to be constructive in the face of this incredible challenge?
It is. It just gets bigger by the day when you hear analyses like that. What can one say? I mean, on the one hand, we're the problem. On the other hand, we have to, through some incredible act of diplomatic deftness, be part of the solution. You know, then we're propping up allies who are sort of insidious forces on terrorism, and we have to somehow say to them, well, you want us to help. You know, it's got to be a quid. You know, he said for 30 years we haven't done anything. We've propped up these regimes. But now the scales have fallen from our eyes. Now American citizens see what this Saudi regime has been all about. And, you know, we can start fresh with them now and say, you want protection? Change. Don't export terrorists. To open up your society. This is our national security at stake in that late nation and in Egypt as well.
I guess there's really no choice but to do that. President Bush reminded us this week that we are great, we are strong, but we really have to do it. But at the same time, that little small voice says, are we really up to this? Are we big enough for this? This is some challenge.
Yeah, and, you know, the challenge throughout has been to the imagination, hasn't it? I mean, Tom Friedman,
yes,
the New York Times columnist, right after the attack called it, you know, failure of imagination. And that's how we're being challenged. We've got to think beyond, out of the box. And you know, the government has been criticized for not doing that. But we're all sort of struggling to think up solutions here and even ways of managing a crisis that looks more like a condition every day. That is to say, this isn't going to go away. This is not something to be solved, but a condition to be managed and managed in such a way that the worst possible outcome, which was just outlined for us, civil war throughout the Middle East.
And we now know that means consequences here in the U.S.
Absolutely.
As well.
We've got to avoid that.
This idea that we've got to break out and find some more creative solution is a very powerful one in my mind at this point. If it's just one foot in front of the other, you know, President Bush says, let's roll. But if we're just rolling with tanks and guns, I mean, partly we have to have that. We have to defend ourselves. But it's going to take some real out-of-the-box thinking, as you say, to find a solution.
Yeah, and of course, crisis can force these things on nations. I mean, the United Nations. You know, you could say that the preventative for World War II was a functioning League of Nations with the United States as a member, a concert of nations to keep the peace. Well, we weren't a member. We were, and it failed. And in the midst of World War II, we said, no, we've got to make that work, and it reinvented the League of Nations as the UN. And so that was a kind of, you know, really epic-making creativity in the middle of a war, recognizing the mistakes we'd made in the past, withdrawing from the world. I think we're challenged similarly today.
But, Jack, you know, as shocking as September 11th was, and how shocking it was, I have the sickening feeling that it may take more shocks to really create this cauldron of creativity that's truly a new response to this challenge.
It may. I mean, just look at the matter of airport security, which we've talked about. You know, or even with the shock, it has yet to be, you know, demonstrably safer. Made demonstrably safer. What could be worse than what happened? And yet we haven't responded to it with the creativity that we're capable of. That's the thing. That's what this society is all about.
Jack, have a great weekend. We'll have to think on this.
All right. You too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.